Good morning, folks. It's time for Democratic Perspective, brought to you by the Verde Valley Independent Democrats, a weekly talk show about political issues facing the Verde Valley, Sedona, Northern Arizona, and the nation at large. Join us for a stimulating, thought-provoking discussion. You'll get the facts as we focus on the real challenges facing Arizonans. Good morning, folks. Steve Williamson here. Sitting across from me is Mike Cosentino.
That's in the flesh.
Yes. And we have an interview today with someone we've had on a lot of times before, right, Mike? Dean Baker.
Dean Baker has a lot of good things to say, a lot of interesting things to say. We go to his website. It's easy to use. I think a nice, clean, become a website judge here lately. But he's co-director of the Center for Economic Policy and Research. And the CEPR website has a lot of good information.
It's really a good website to pull up information quickly, folks. A lot of the stuff we'll be talking with Dr. Baker about is really on the website. It's on articles. He writes widely internationally about economic affairs. Dean, are you there?
Yes, I'm here. How are you doing?
Good, good, good. We wanted to start out with some research that we've heard that you're doing about Bain, Romney and Bain, and what Bain Capital actually is, because Romney's running on it as his claim to fame, right? He's running away from his record as governor. It's all about his private sector experience.
Well, just to be clear, a couple things. First, it's my colleague Eileen Applebaum's research, one of my colleagues here at the Center for Economic and Policy Research, and she's not looking specifically at Bain. She's been looking at private equity because I think to a lot of people it is kind of a big black box. And
absolutely.
I'm saying that as an economist that, you know, I had kind of a sense of it, but, you know, I've learned much more from her research that's ongoing. First off, it's about $2 trillion worth in terms of the capital held, so it's more than 10% of the corporate sector right now, so it's a really big deal. But what's striking is that, realize he's passed on, but Steve Jobs are running for office, we know what he did, or going back, you know, we know what Ford did. You know, we could identify the company, we could identify how he made his money, how these people made their money. With private equity, you can't do that because it's much more amorphous. And, you know, they have a story that they like to tell, that they find companies that are poorly managed, having trouble, they put in good management, give access to capital. There are cases like that, but that's the exception. What's much more typically the case is that they do financial engineering. So they find a company and they go, hey, you know, you don't have any debt. We could load you up with debt. And the reason why that's a good thing for a private equity company is if they're paying money in interest rather than paying out dividends, well, dividends are taxable. Interest is tax-free. So that's the sort of thing. There's many, many other things like that. If you go into bankruptcy, well, you could relieve yourself of debt. And very often, you know, sometimes you have people that are buying bonds knowing that they're high risk, but the debtors go well beyond that. So you have suppliers, you know, that often extend credit to a company that might have been purchased, you know, retailer Friendly's ice cream. That was an example that my colleagues looked at. It's a long-standing ice cream chain on the East Coast. That was taken over by a private equity company. They filled it up with debt. They stripped it of real estate. It's real estate, so they created a separate real estate investment trust, and they had to pay rent for the stores that they were in each month.
And that's clever. And,
yeah, well, and then they end up going into bankruptcy, and they had no assets. So everyone, you know, all the suppliers, everyone basically took a hit. So these are the sorts of things that private equity routinely does. Now, how much Bain did, again, we don't really know because it's not an open book. You know, if I want to find out General Motors, how much did you invest? You know, all this stuff, they're a publicly traded company. I could find out, you know, all this information. You know, it's public information. I could go on their website and, you know, find a great deal about that. You go to Bain Capital, they'll go, well, you know, we're private. We don't have to tell you anything.
It's a real so one of the purposes for private something like Bain Capital would be to really game the system in a really unusual way, at least from a private guy's standpoint here. to do would think the opposite of what you think good business would be.
Exactly, and that's what's so striking, because, you know, one can make the argument that, you know, being the head of a company, a successful company, isn't necessarily what you need for running a country. I mean, there's obviously different skills, and, you know, there's some sort of obvious points that, you know, from the standpoint of a company, if you lay off, you know, half your workforce, you can still get everything done. You go, well, that's great, because, you know, you've just saved a lot of money. But from the standpoint of the country, I mean, we don't want half our workforce laid off. So there's a very different set of skills, clearly, whether it's, you know, gets you situated to be president or, you know, political leadership. That's, I'll let other people debate that, but clearly a different set of skills. But what Romney did, what Bain Capital does, is not that. They're not building up a company. An awful lot of it is about gaming the system. And, you know, any company or individual could do very well by gaming the system, but we can't have a whole system built on gaming the system. That doesn't work.
And that's where a lot of the profit, the increasing amount of the profit in the American economic system is gaming the economy. I had a friend who worked in the business in New York, and she said the closer you are to the money supply, the easier it is to grab a little piece to make more money. So if you're making widgets or computers like Steve Jobs was doing, you're further from that being able to manipulate the money supply, which it can be small little maneuvers.
I want to repeat that statistic that he said, that these kinds of private equity firms, Bain Capitals, are 10% or more of the corporate economy of the United States.
Yeah.
And they present it as if they're saving endangered companies. Is that what they're doing? And they combine private equity with venture capital. Venture capital people are actually taking chances, right?
Right. Venture capital, the idea of venture capital is you find, you know, upstart companies and you say, hey, you know, this looks like a good prospect, and, you know, you give them the money they need to move on, you know, move on to the next phase, to expand. And, you know, venture capital, they know a lot of those companies are going to fail. You know, that's understood. You're taking a big risk there. You know, you have this computer company that has a good software, but is it going to beat out whatever, Microsoft or Google, whoever else is out there? You don't know, but you're placing a bet there.
Let's segue into the Romney-Ryan budget, if you don't mind. I want to read the first paragraph of one of your articles. It says, if the news media had to work for a living, this is what they would all be asking right now. The reason is simple. You're talking about the projections of the Congressional Budget Office made for the Representative Ryan budget implied that he literally wants to shut down the federal government.
Yeah, and what's striking here, he gave numbers to the Congressional Budget Office. This is the way this works. So just, you know, in Washington, everyone, Congressional Budget Office, equivalent God or whatever, but just so people understand, Congressional Budget Office works for Congress. They're nonpartisan. You know, I have no idea who's a Democrat, who's a Republican there. And they score plans that are given to them by Congress at the direction of members of Congress. And, you know, Representative Ryan's he's the chair of the House Budget Committee, he's an important member of Congress. So he gave his plan to be scored by them. What I'm emphasizing here is that they're not putting down numbers that, you know, he doesn't like. You know, I mean, he might not like them. They won't make up numbers for him. But it's not that they go off in the dark somewhere and they come back with numbers and they make fun of Representative Ryan. They go, okay, what is your plan involve? What are you trying to do here? They put it down. He goes, that's it. That's right. You got it. Well, what their numbers show is that when you get to 2040, you know, he's projecting out for the long term, and I'm not picking on him for a distant number because he's made a point of emphasizing this. When you get it out to 2040, pull out Social Security, pull out Medicare and the other health care portions of the budget, all he has left in there is about 4.5% of GDP. Everything else in the budget. Now, the big item that's left there is the military, which is currently about 4% of GDP, and he said he wants to keep the military at its current size or actually make larger. You have to be really good at arithmetic. If you have 4.5% of GDP and the military is taking up around 4%, you have almost nothing for anything else. And then you get out to 2050, and it's 3.75% of GDP. In other words, you don't even have enough to pay for the military. So what I've been saying is, you know, how come no one in the media is asking him, is this really what you mean? Do you really intend to get rid of the Food and Drug Administration, the, you know, the Park Service, the, you know, the federal role in education and transportation, NASA, you know, and on the list, funding healthcare research? Is that really what you mean? I mean, maybe he does, but that is what he wrote down.
Well, both Romney and Ryan have plain that the numbers, the analysis are unfair to them. And I think you made a good point when you said, well, if the numbers are unfair, if we're just putting in numbers to make you look bad, what are they? And there's deep silence about that. They just want to say, you know, garbage in, garbage out. They don't really want to discuss it, do they? I mean, they don't want to discuss
the issue. No, and that's why, you know, the whole point of this is to try to be concrete. Now, you know, I've worked with people at the Congressional Budget Office. They try to be straight. You know, part of it is that, you know, their career civil service, they're not easy to be fired. On the other hand, you know, if Ryan could show that, you know, I told them X and they wrote down Y, well, that's the sort of thing you can get fired. I mean, yeah, you know, if they did it once, yeah, anyone makes a typo. But, you know, no, I kept telling them, you know, there's almost no way on earth. I mean, you couldn't imagine that, you know, here he is, he's working at whoever at the Congressional Budget Office, and he keeps telling them, no, that's not what my budget does, you know. And the person keeps insisting on writing down something that, you know, that Ryan, you know, it's against what Ryan has called for in his budget. So, yeah, if he's got, if something's being misrepresented, you know, none of these people are shy, shrinking violets, they're not stupid, you know, put it on the table. Here's what I wanted in there, and they didn't get that right.
But they don't want to do that, do they?
Well, they don't want to do it because I don't think there's anything there. I mean, basically, I think, you know, CBO, there have been other analyses of their tax plan. The Tax Policy Center, Brookings and Urban Institute announced their tax proposal that concluded it would mean big tax increases for a lot of middle-income people because they're going to take away things like the mortgage interest deduction, the deduction for employer-provided health care insurance, which will mean a lot of people will pay higher taxes.
Well, why is it treated so respectfully then if so many organizations and so many economists can actually analyze it and see that it's kind of, in a sense, sort of flim-flam stuff? It sounds good. We'll end the deficit and stuff, but apparently the Romney budget, will actually increase the deficit.
It is kind of striking. You know, the right has made a real effort to build up Representative Ryan as, you know, kind of their, you know, whiz kid, genius or whatever. And it's a little mind-boggling to me. I mean, I don't think he's stupid. I've met him. I actually debated him back in 2005 in his district on Social Security. So, I've, you know, I had some dealings with him. You know, I don't think he's a moron or anything. But it just, you know, there's not a there. You know, so you look at these budgets and you go, there's not a great budget there. There's, you know, I mean, maybe it's more than some other people have done. You know, I'm sure it is. But it's not like he has some great plans. And, you know, just to give you an example, I think it kind of speaks to how the media here treats him. On Saturday, the Washington Post had an article where they were just in awe of the fact that Representative Ryan had used the word baseline in talking about the budget. You know, of course, baseline is something that, you know, it's common for us who do budget work to talk about all the time. That means if, you know, we leave things as they are, that's the baseline, you know, and then you go, you want to change it, but you want to cut taxes, or you want to increase spending, or whatever it is you want to do. So baseline is you leave. Anyhow, he used that term, and, you know, the Washington Post had a whole article that was devoted largely to the fact that he used the term baseline, saying, wow, this guy really is a budget wonk. He knows what he's talking about.
But what do you think his deepest economic ideas are? Is he really, he's presented himself, and the Republicans have presented him, and the press has presented him, as this deficit hawk. But when you look at the budget he's proposing, you get a very different impression. Well, so what do you think where is he coming from economically? Because he seems to be dominating Romney's discussion of economy now.
Well, I think it's about, you know, basically it's about the effort to shift, to redistribute income upwards. So, you know, he's in favor of tax policies that redistribute income upwards. Certainly his approach to Medicare, it would leave, you know, people without being able to afford health care in their retirement years. So basically, you know, where he sees a situation where the government is spending money in a way that would have the effect of benefiting the bulk of the population, he wants to cut it back. And he wants to cut back taxes on wealthy people and, you know, seems perfectly content to either let them rise or at least not fall for more moderate income people. So I think it's really redistributional policy. It's about shifting income upwards.
But it's upward, and which is, you know, it seems like the Republicans build a lot of things on fear. They want the American public to be afraid of a lot of things. Democrats only want people to be afraid of Republicans, but it seems like Republicans have a half a dozen things, and deficit is one of them, and a crumbling Social Security is another, and a unfunded or poorly funded Medicare is another. But but especially the deficit. That's, I think from here to the election, we're going to hear in the next 70 some odd days until at least this election cycle is over. The economy will go on after November 6th. Is that true, Mr. Baker?
I think it's a safe bet.
Yeah, okay. But seriously, so much of this is built on fear. What are the fears that they seem to be putting out and Ryan is supporting in his budget?
Well, certainly, the deficit hysteria has, been played up endlessly, and, we will continue to see that. And it's important for people to understand, we didn't have large deficits until we had the downturn. So the idea that, we've had this chronic problem, the government is just spending money left and right, well, no, that's actually not true.
Good point.
We had relatively modest deficits. The deficits that we had in 2007 was 1.2% of GDP. We could run a deficit like that literally forever. And it was projected to stay that level, even before we had the end of the Bush tax cuts. So we were looking at relatively modest deficits until the economy collapsed in 2008. And the story here is fairly straightforward. We need something to fill that gap. There's this huge gap of demand created by the collapse of the housing bubble. And all we have is the government sector to do it. So, it's fine. People don't like the government sector. You could hate the government sector, but private sector doesn't just jump up and fill a demand gap like that because we want it to. There's no economic theory that says how that works. And, we have a lot of evidence it doesn't.
Speaking of the one fear that we're hearing about, so Social Security is the next thing. I liked what you said. You talked about the different definitions of courage in Washington. That Joe Biden's statement on protecting Social Security took courage, and then apparently the Washington Post. I didn't read the article. Did an editorial hammering his use of courage. It took more courage to tweak Social Security. What's going to happen?
This was not an op-ed piece. This was a Washington Post major editorial.
It's a major editorial, yeah, and it was striking because, here it is, they're criticizing Biden's lack of courage, and then they're calling for cuts in Social Security, but they don't have the courage to say they want to cut Social Security. They say they want to tweak the cost of living adjustment. So my guess is a lot of people read that, didn't understand that tweak the cost of living adjustment meant basically a 3% cut in Social Security benefits. So I find that, a bit ironic, but humorous. But, the reality here is that, they're looking, you have a lot of people in Washington really look to cut Social Security, and it's kind of mind-boggling to me, because, we know how people are getting by on Social Security. The average benefit's a bit over $1,200 a month, and that's more than half the income for two-thirds of retirees.
More than half their income, then.
Yeah, so we're looking at these people, and, if it's more than half their income, we're getting less than $2,400 a month, and we're somehow thinking they're living too high on the hog. I'm a little at a loss to understand, what are these people thinking?
Could we, when I look around northern Arizona, I see people that really no longer have pension benefits coming. Their 401ks and stuff fluctuate all over the place with the stock market. And could we increase Social Security rather than come up with ways to cut it?
There you go.
I mean, because people, $1,200 is not enough.
Because it's clear most people, and I'm focusing on middle income, not because I don't care about low income people, but, low income people have been, scraping by their whole lives. It perhaps isn't surprising, not good, but, it's not surprising. They're not doing very well in retirement. But you have a lot of middle-income people had, decent-paying jobs in the scheme of things, spent their whole life working. They get to retirement. They don't have a traditional pension. And, you could yell at them. Maybe they should have saved more in their 401k, but there's all sorts of reasons why they don't. There are a lot of fees there. They eat up their savings. And we know the typical retiree, the person in 55 to 64, has a total of $170,000 in wealth. And just to be clear, that includes everything they have. That includes the equity in their home, includes whatever they have in a 401k or other retirement account, if they have some other savings, if they have some money in the stock market, value of their car, includes everything.
Sounds
so
right.
A way I like to think about that is that's roughly the price of a typical house. So the typical person, someone in the middle of the income distribution, just approaching retirement, they could take everything they own and basically pay off their mortgage, give or take a little bit. Then they're entirely dependent on Social Security. And half the people are worse off than that. So I look at that and go, yeah, we should be talking about raising Social Security. We shouldn't be talking about lowering it. But here in D.C., people go nuts if you say that.
Why do we never talk about raising Social Security? Could we, I think it's 6.2% from the employer, 6.2% from the employee. It works because, you know, I know young people out here, they would never think about their retirement. They're 20 years old or 21 years old and they're working. And it's only because you pay a small amount of percentage over a whole long period of your working life that Social Security works. What could be done so that it would bring more support to people than the current kind of minimal figure?
Well, you can simply up the benefit. I mean, you could have something like a, you know, an increase of, you know, whether it's $200-$300 a month across the board. You could have it taken back for higher income people so that, you know, someone who earned $80,000 a year, maybe won't see an increase in benefits. But you could, it's not too hard to structure something that would give a higher payout to most beneficiaries and really wouldn't cost all that much, but likely mean a big difference in people's living standards. Now, how would you pay for that? We are looking at a shortfall in the program. The Congressional Budget Office projects after 2038, you'd only be able to pay about 80% of scheduled benefits. Well, one thing you can do is raise the cap. So right now people don't pay taxes on income above $110,000, so you could have people pay it on all their income. That might be difficult, but you could certainly raise it to $200,000, $250,000. That would raise a lot of money for the program. The other thing is, over a long enough period of time, I don't see a problem with raising the tax rate. Now, important to understand, we expect people to see wage gains. They haven't, because so much income has gone to the top end of the income distribution. But if people had normal wage gains, if wages kept pace with productivity growth, they'd be increasing 1-1.5% a year. So in that context, if you took, say, 5% of their wage gains and used it to pay for more generous Social Security benefits, that strikes me as a reasonable thing to do and probably something a lot of people would support. But the key point there is you have to have the wage gains, and at the moment, at least, we're not getting it because so much income is going to the top.
So why aren't we seeing wage gains? Why is the middle class wages and benefits, everything stagnant?
I thought there
and
was
all
some
the money's going up to the top 1%. I don't begrudge them getting some money, but I mean,
well,
is this a stable situation, Dean? I mean,
One is the current downturn. I mean, you know, right now we're sitting here over 8% unemployment. You know, that means for very weak bargaining power. But even before the downturn, most workers were not seeing the benefits of productivity growth. And we've done a lot of things to structure the labor market in such a way that will be the case. So, for example, our trade policy is quite explicit. We want to make our workers, our manufacturing workers, compete with the lowest paid labor anywhere in the world. And the predicted and actual result of that is it lowers their wages. You know, if you're an auto worker, you're a textile worker, whatever it might be, and you have to compete with someone in Mexico or China who's working for, you know, $1 an hour, well, that's going to drive down your wages. We expect that. That's exactly what happens. We don't make our doctors and lawyers compete in the same way because they have powerful lobbies. They don't allow that. So that pushes wages downward. We have, you know, our Wall Street, our financial industry's a cesspool. You know, basically we have too big to fail insurance that we give to the largest banks, which means that increases their profits. And, you know, needless to say, their CEOs make huge paychecks out of that.
It really seems like the whole economic system is rolling along without my buddies down at the coffee shop. And when I leave the show, I'm going to go down to the coffee shop in Old Town Cottonwood, and all these figures play out exactly that. The retired cop, you know, he's doing okay. The retired teacher, yeah, you know, his Social Security allows him to buy a little more fancy coffee and a nice dessert. But half, easily 60% of the people I'm sitting there with are living on $1,200 or less a month, and it's
really not enough money to live on. I had an interesting conversation with a Japanese executive, and he said, and it was very interesting for people from our generation, remember when Japanese labor was undercutting American labor and bringing in all kinds of stuff. And he said, you know, Japan, we really cannot compete with China, Vietnam, and Indonesia. Our people can't live on the kind of wages they're making there. We need to do something. And his saying, well, we need to get together with America and come up with some kind of plan, because the people who once undercut our wages are getting undercut by still poorer countries where the money is very important.
Well, a lot of this can be addressed by the dollar policy, which is something ostensibly under our control. But it's very hard to do anything about that, primarily because you have powerful interests that like to have the high dollar. So you have, you know, our financial sector likes to be able to be big actors elsewhere in the world. So if the dollar is more highly valued, they're more powerful. You have companies like Walmart that have set up low-cost supply chains in China and elsewhere. They don't want to see those their advantage dwindle as the dollar falls against China's currency. You also have companies, you know, General Electric, most major manufacturing companies have set up operations in the developing world. They too, you know, aren't anxious to see the dollar fall. So it's not as though we can't do anything. We can. It's actually simple. What's supposed to happen is the dollar should be falling to bring our trade deficit down, bring it closer into balance. But we have a lot of interest both here and abroad that are anxious to see the dollar remain overvalued, and you know the trade deficit and the job loss it implies doesn't bother them.
Okay, one of the things, the other thing I want to, not that we've exhausted this topic by any means, but let's talk about, I want to squeeze in healthcare if we can. And you write that the enormous inefficiency of the healthcare system drives up the cost. And this is, you state all the things that some of the others say, that the cost of drugs, the cost of medical equipment, the cost of supplies, hospital services, are all driven up by this incredible inefficiency. And then you talk about $1.2 trillion a year healthcare tax situation.
Yeah, well, I was saying that, you know, if you compare our costs to any other country in the world, well, comparable countries, I mean, I'm not picking, you know, poor countries.
Sure, where, yeah, Canada, okay, right.
Yeah, where they have comparable care, arguably better, but whatever, comparable. I mean, we're better in some areas, are better in others. But the point is, very comparable care, certainly comparable or better health outcomes. We pay about $1.2 trillion more for our health care, for what we get, with nothing really to show for it. And from the standpoint of the economy, that's basically the same as if the government put a $1.2 trillion annual tax on health care.
And this it's based on inefficiency of the delivery system. We're not talking about the quality of a particular doctor or something like that.
Exactly. So we're paying twice as much and getting the same thing.
So my son takes his baby to the emergency room rather than having insurance and going to the doctor.
That certainly can be part of the story. So the point here is we're paying a huge amount of money and not getting anything for it. And if this were a tax, if the government, suppose, you know, we have people running around screaming bloody murder because, you know, President Obama has a few relatively small taxes associated with the Affordable Care Act. Imagine he proposed a $1.2 trillion annual tax. You know, that'd be $12 trillion over the next decade. You know, we'd have people having heart attacks. But in effect, that's what the inefficiencies of our healthcare system do. It's the same thing.
And yet people don't want the healthcare system reformed.
Well, I think very few people realize how bad it is. You know, policy wonks. You know, we look at these numbers, and, you know, I could say that here in Washington to, you know, people who are healthcare experts, they know these numbers, so it's not a secret to them. But, you know, for most people in the public, they don't see this written about in the paper. I don't think they know that, you know, everyone else has their care provided at roughly half the cost. And that, as I say, they have comparable outcomes. We rank near the bottom in life expectancies, at least among the wealthy countries.
We're running out of time. Thanks for being with us. I hope you come back on the show after the election, and let's talk about where we are economically, what could be done.
Yeah, we do have a lot of candidates and whatnot coming up for the next several weeks between now and the election. But like I said, after November 6th, we'll still have the economy to worry about.
Great. Happy to do it.
Next week, Darrell Johnson wrote a report the rise of the radical right-wing terrorism for the Homeland Security Department, and it started a firestorm when it was leaked to a station. And he was basically treated the same way Shirley Sherrod was. He was basically forced out, or his report was trashed, even though it didn't say much of the stuff he was accused of saying. Next week, Darrell Johnson, the week after Tom Paley. Tom Paley is another economist that we talked to. We'll be talking about where the economy should go.
We've been talking to Dean Baker, and we're talking about the economy. And don't forget, and these things get a little complex. You can go to his website at the Center for Economic Policy Research, and you can go to our website and hear our interviews with him and others at vvid.org. That's vvid.org. We have all the podcasts of our interviews on Democratic Perspectives.
And our interview with Dr. Dean Baker will be up in about 2 days.
That's correct.
Thanks very much for tuning in, folks. Democratic Perspective. Next week, Daryl Johnson. What happened? Thrown to the dogs. And listening to Democratic Perspective, brought to you by the Verde Valley Independent Democrats, a weekly talk show focusing on the political issues facing the Verde Valley, Sedona, Northern Arizona, and the nation at large. Catch us every Monday morning after the 8 o'clock news, right here on AM 780 KAZM. It's beautiful out there, folks. Have a great day.